Geekscape.com.
The Natural History of the Caucasian and Negro Races, Part 1. Before entering upon the natural history of the human race, it is indispensably necessary, as a preliminary step, to examine some points in chronology, and to take a glance at the early history of Egypt. I must show that the Caucasian or white and the Negro races were distinct at a very remote date, and that the Egyptians were Caucasians. Unless this point can be established, the contest must be abandoned. In order to show how completely we are left in the dark on this subject by the Old Testament, it will be necessary to make some allusion to the diversity of chronological computations. The commonly received opinion is that our globe was created 4,004 years before Christ, and that the deluge took place 2,348 BC. These computations, let it be remembered, were made by Archbishop Usher, were adopted by an Act of the British Parliament, and are the dates annexed to our Bibles. Now, no one will pretend that Archbishop Usher was inspired, or that there have not been other divines as learned as himself, and still less will anyone pretend that the British Parliament is distinguished either for inspiration or piety. These dates, then, are entitled to no more respect than any other human opinions. Some may be surprised to learn that there are, besides that of Bishop Usher, more than 300 computations for the creation and deluge. These computations, too, are made by learned divines, and differ at least 1,500 years. I will cite a few only of the most prominent, as I am desirous of avoiding prolixity. Josephus states that the creation was 5,586 BC. The Hebrew text states that it was 4,161 BC, and the English Bible states that it was 4,004 BC. Josephus states that the deluge was 3,246 BC. The Hebrew text states that it was 2,228 BC. And the English Bible states that it was 2,348 BC. These are sufficient to show how widely the highest and most competent authorities differ on these points. There is even a difference of 10 years in the dates given for the birth of Christ, and Moses has left no data, nor is there anything in the history of Egypt by which his time can be determined. Modern science establishes beyond the possibility of a doubt the fact that these dates, for the creation at least, are too short, and probably by many thousand years. I presume there are few, if any, divines of the present day, conversant with geology and natural history, who do not concur in this opinion, and who do not believe there have been other floods, besides the one spoken of by Moses. In writing the natural history of the human race, we must commence with the subsidence of the deluge. This, as I have stated, is placed by Usher at 2,348 BC. Now, I propose to show, by positive proofs from recent examination of Egyptian monuments, that this date is erroneous, that Negroes existed in Africa before this date of the flood, and that there is reason to believe they did not descend from Noah's family. Moses dwelt in Egypt some 1,500 years BC, and is said to have been learned in all the wisdom of this singular and interesting country. We have all heard from our childhood of her pyramids, her magnificent temples, her obelisks, and other monuments of her surprising greatness. These monuments are embossed with hieroglyphics, which have puzzled the brains of the most learned antiquarians for centuries, and strange to say, the honour of discovering a key by which they could be deciphered has remained for our age. About 20 years ago, Champollion, who was sent to Egypt by the French government, during his researches, found the celebrated Rosetta Stone, on which were engraven three inscriptions in different characters. The first was composed of these hieroglyphics, the second was Demotic, or common written language, of Egypt, and the third was Greek. The event recorded on this stone was the coronation of Epiphanes, which took place at Memphis in March 196 BC, and the whole inscription would take up two ordinary octavo pages. On comparing the three different inscriptions, they were found to be exact translations of each other, and a key was thus at once furnished, by which most of the chronological mysteries of Egypt were to be unravelled. Since that time, Egyptian hieroglyphics have been read and translated with almost as much ease as Greek or Hebrew. We now know more of the history of Egypt prior to Moses than we do of the history of France or England prior to Charlemagne or Alfred. I am mainly indebted to Mr. J. S. Glidden for the facts I shall use on this subject. Mr. Glidden lived in Egypt 23 years, is intelligent, well-informed, and I learn from those who know him well, is an amiable and honourable gentleman. A joint commission was sent to Egypt some years ago by the French government and the Grand Duke of Tuscany, headed by two of the most distinguished men of the age, Champollion and Rosellini, for the purpose of examining the monuments of this country. On their return home, they each published works which have been the greatest literary wonders of the age. Mr. Glidden, in addition to his opportunities of examining their works, has enjoyed their friendship and intimacy and has travelled over the same ground they have and examined the monuments for himself. Now here are three gentlemen of character and competency who have no object in teaching falsehoods, and when they state a fact as certain, we must believe them. They must know more of these subjects than Oxford and Andover professors. Historians have assigned to Egypt 31 dynasties, comprising 378 kings, previous to the conquest by Alexander the Great, which took place 332 BC, and a large proportion of these dynasties have been verified by the hieroglyphic inscriptions. The obelisks, tombs, and other monuments had inscribed upon them the name of each monarch, the number of years he reigned, the principal events of his reign, and by putting together these reigns in their proper order, we get at positive dates. The positive, monumental data go back to the year BC 2272, which is within 72 years of Usher's date of the flood. The list of monuments are not perfect beyond that date. Many have been destroyed, in consequence of which the date of some of the kings cannot be determined with precision. Besides Manetho, the Egyptian historian, we have the authority of Herodotus, Eratosthenes, Diodorus, Josephus, the old Egyptian chronicle, as well as the hieroglyphics, to prove that Menes was the first king of Egypt. It is certain that he reigned long previous to the positive date above given, and Champollion and Rosellini place him about 2,750 years BC, which is 400 years before our date of the deluge. The pyramids were built between the time of Menes, the first king, and 2272 BC, and hieroglyphic writing was common at the time of the pyramids. Now all these statements are not mere conjectures, but positive facts, engraven upon stone, at the time the events recorded transpired. They are just as much to be relied upon as the inscriptions on the Bunker Hill or Battle Monument at Baltimore. Another proof of the remote date of the flood, or of its limited extent, is seen in the great age of certain trees in Africa and Central America. Distinguished botanists assert that some of these trees are 6,000 years old. Full-grown trees may have been created when Adam was, but we have no reason to believe they have been since. This fact, then, which no botanist doubts, proves that the flood took place at least 6,000 years ago, or it was not universal. It is recorded that the largest pyramid took 100,000 men, 20 years to build it. The immense masses of stone of which it is built were brought from a great distance and transported across the Nile, and it is recorded in hieroglyphics that it took 10 years to prepare the materials before the construction commenced. Now, let me ask, if several hundred of these pyramids existed, with a vast number of other stupendous monuments, if Memphis and Thebes were built and contained with the country around, a population which could execute all these wonderful things, if all the useful arts and sciences, together with astronomy, existed at this remote date, how many centuries previous must this country have been populated? It is difficult for the mind to reach it. Reflect for a moment on the slow progress which a nation must make from infancy to such perfection. The world has been most egregiously deceived by Greek and Roman historians, Herodotus particularly, who has been called the father of history, should, with more propriety, be called the father of romance. Herodotus was in Egypt about 430 BC, during the dominion of the Persians, long after she had fallen from her pristine greatness. He was ignorant of the language, was looked upon like other foreigners as an impure Gentile, did not associate with the higher castes, and received his information as other travellers, through ignorant and often dishonest interpreters. The same remarks apply with still greater force to Diodorus and other writers of later times. They were totally unable to decipher the hieroglyphics and recorded vague traditions and stories of events 2,000 or 3,000 years before their day. Of what they saw with their own eyes, they may be supposed to speak with some degree of accuracy, perhaps as much as would a Russian or Egyptian traveller in the United States. Manetho is the historian most worthy of credit, as his dynasties and other facts are in accordance with the hieroglyphic inscriptions, which is not only the best test we could have at this late day, but a test which is almost conclusive. Manetho was an Egyptian priest who lived before Christ about 260 years. He, of course, was familiar with the language and literature of his country, and as his history was written by the order of one of the Ptolemies, who was then on the throne, of course the archives of the nation and all sources of information were thrown open to him. Hieroglyphic writing was then in use, and he was familiar with it. Unfortunately, there is no copy of Manetho's works extant, and we have only extracts from them in the works of Josephus and others. Next to a pure copy of the Bible, I know of no work so important as a correct and full copy of his writings. It is to be hoped that one may yet be discovered. Egypt is the earliest point of civilization of which we have any records. The history of this country is doubly interesting to us, as it has been asserted by most historians it was originally inhabited by Negroes, and that from this race all the arts and sciences have been derived. I shall, however, be able to show satisfactorily that recent investigations have overthrown all previously received opinions on this subject, and that the Egyptians were a Caucasian race. In the allotment of territories to the offspring of Noah, Egypt was given as an inheritance to Mizraim, the son of Ham. He must have proceeded with his companions from the banks of the Euphrates, along the borders of the Mediterranean, and across the Isthmus of Suez, to his point of destination, as Lower Egypt, near the mouth of the Nile, was most easy of access, and the most fertile country. It is reasonable to suppose that here the first settlement was made. Mizraim, being a descendant of Noah, was of course a Caucasian. Shem and Ham were twin brothers. The word Shem means white, and Ham means dark or swarthy, but not black. It is probably, therefore, that there was the same difference between them that we often see between brothers here. Many have supposed Ham to be the progenitor of the Negro race. There was no curse upon him, and there is nothing in the Bible which induces such a belief. But this point is settled by the fact which I shall prove, that the Egyptians were not Negroes. The curse of heaven fell upon Canaan, but we have no reason to believe that the curse was a physical one. Canaan, too, took possession of Palestine and not any part of Africa, and his descendants were Caucasians. Mr. J. S. Glidden asserts that it can be proven by paintings and sculptures of a date earlier than 1500 years before Christ that the Canaanites and Negroes were as different as the whites and Negroes are of the present age, and that the Negroes then presented the same physical characteristics which they do now, after a lapse of 3,500 years. The drawings and sculptures of this early date often represent Negroes as slaves and captives, and as an evidence of the estimation in which the black race was held, even at this remote date, the inscriptions designated their country as barbarian and their race as perverse. You will remember that the Nile runs north and empties into the Mediterranean, and that it takes its rise towards the centre of Africa, far into the country, which is now, and has been, as far back as history can trace, inhabited by Negroes. According to most historians, civilization commenced high up the Nile, in Ethiopia, and was thence brought down towards its mouth into Egypt. Late investigations, however, have disproved this assertion, and shown by positive facts that the oldest monuments are found in Egypt, particularly at Memphis. It is now proven that time and circumstance did not effect any material change in Ham's progeny, and that his lineal descendants were pure Caucasians. They very naturally were modified in Upper Egypt by admixture with the Ethiopians, Arabs, and others who bordered on their territory. To this day, Mr. Glidden says, the Fellahs, or people of Lower Egypt, are but little mixed. Now I would ask, with Mr. Glidden, how long must it have taken for the descendants of Ham to have gone from the banks of the Euphrates in Asia into Africa and up the Nile 1500 miles, there grow into a powerful nation, carry the arts and sciences to the highest state of perfection, and next, as an additional evidence of civilization, turn perfectly black, afterwards come down the Nile again 1500 miles to its mouth, and to cap the climax, turn white again. This, too, in a climate where no one's skin has changed in the last 4,000 years. Now, is there any miracle in the Bible more wonderful than this? I should like to know what it is. All these events, too, according to the Hebrew version, happen in 100 years, and according to the Septuagint, 500. Besides the proofs drawn from the hieroglyphics, paintings, and sculptures, there are others which not only strongly corroborate, but amount to perfect demonstration of the fact that the ancient Egyptians were Caucasians. The great naturalist Cuvier has spent much time and labour on this point, and after a careful examination of 50 mummies, asserts that they are Caucasian and have no resemblance whatsoever to the Negro. The head, the whole skeleton, and the hair are Caucasian. In this opinion, all distinguished naturalists concur. Dr. Morton, of Philadelphia, who has devoted much attention to these subjects, and who has acquired a distinguished reputation, not only in this country, but throughout the scientific world, has thrown very important light upon this point. Dr. Morton's facts are drawn from an examination of 100 Egyptian heads taken from 7 different repositories of the dead, particularly Memphis and Thebes. These heads were collected and presented to him by Mr. Glidden, who was consul at Cairo for 23 years. In a paper read by Dr. Morton before the American Philosophical Society, he first took a view of those nations with whom the Egyptians appear to have held intercourse, either for war or commerce, in the early epochs of their history. And among those whom he has been able to identify from a comparison of the heads figured in the work of Rossellini are the Celts, the Scythians, the Pelasgic and Shemitic nations, the Hindus, Arabs and Negroes. He has classed the whole series of heads in the following manner. First, Arcto-Egyptians, under which designation are embraced the purer Caucasian nations, as seen in the Semitic tribes of Western Asia and the Pelasgic communities of Southern Europe. Second, Austro-Egyptians, in which the cranium blends the characteristics of the Hindu and Southern Arab, which people, in the opinion of the author, were engrafted on the aboriginal population of Ethiopia, and thus gave rise to the celebrated Meroite nations of antiquity. Third, Negroloid crania, in which the osteological development corresponds to that of the Negro, while the hair, though harsh and sometimes wiry, is long and not woolly, thus presenting the combination of features which are familiar in the mulatto grades of the present day. Fourth, Negro. In many crania, the Arcto-Egyptian, Austro-Egyptian, and Semitic characters are variously blended, while a few also present traces of Negro lineage, modifying the features of the preceding types. The Caucasian crania, in the whole, constitute 9 in 10, the Negroloid about 1 in 14, and out of the whole 100 skulls, there is but one unmixed Negro. A very striking fact, too, is that the pure Caucasian heads are found at Memphis, near the mouth of the Nile, and as you ascend the river into the interior of Africa and approach Nubia, the Caucasian character is gradually lost. They become mingled with Negro and other tribes. The author refers to blending of Arcto-Egyptian and Austral Egyptian and other communities to three principal periods of Egyptian history. First, the conquest by the Hyksos, or Shepherd Kings, 2082 BC, when the Egyptians of all ranks were driven into Ethiopia for a period of 260 years. Second, the Ethiopian dynasty of three kings, which lasted 40 years, beginning 719 years before Christ. Third, the conquest by Cambyses, 525 years before Christ, when the distinctions of caste and nation were comparatively disregarded for upwards of two centuries, during which period the people of Asia, Europe and Nigritia were freely admitted into Egypt. Dr. Morton's ethnographical researches, conjoined with the evidence of history and the monuments, have led him to draw the following conclusions. First, that Egypt was originally peopled by the Caucasian race. Second, that the great preponderance of heads, conforming in all their characters to those of the purer Caucasian nations, as seen in the Pelasgic and Semitic tribes, suggests the inference that the valley of the Nile derived its primitive civilized inhabitants from one of these sources, and that the greater proportion of this series of crania in Lower Egypt may, perhaps, serve to indicate the seats of early colonization. Third, that the Austral Egyptian or Meroite communities were in a great measure derived from the Indo-Arabian stock, thus pointing to a triple Caucasian source for the origin of the Egyptians, when regarded as one people, extending from Meroe to the Delta. Fourth, that the Negro race exists in the catacombs in the mixed or Negroloid character, that even in this modified type, their presence is comparatively infrequent, and that if Negroes, as is more probable, were numerous in Egypt, Then their social position was chiefly, in ancient times, what it yet is, that of plebeians, servants, and slaves. Independent of the bearing of many of these interesting facts, the conclusion to my mind is irresistible, that the civilization of Egypt is attributable to these Caucasian heads, because civilization does not now, and never has, as far as we know from history, been carried to this perfection by any other race than the Caucasian. How can any reasoning mind come to any other conclusion? It is clear, then, that history, the Egyptian monuments, her paintings and sculptures, the examination of skulls by Cuvier, Morton and others, analogy, and everything else connected with this country, combine to prove beyond the possibility of a doubt that the ancient Egyptian race were Caucasians. Positive historical facts prove, too, that Egypt has been conquered in early times by various inferior tribes, and the blood of her people adulterated. Besides the conquest of the Hyksos, the Ethiopians, Persians, and others, she has more recently been conquered by the Greeks, the Romans, and the Turks. But even the pure blood of Greece and Rome could not wash out the black stain, both moral and physical, which she has received.
You're listening to Radio Aryan at RadioAryan.com.